Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
The Biggest Loser inspired millions of Americans who watched overweight contestants diet and exercise their way to vastly trimmer physiques. Each season, the most successful among them radically changed the shapes of their bodies and imagined they had changed the course of the rest of their lives. But last month, the journal Obesity released a disturbing report. 6 years after their dramatic weight loss, 14 contestants studied had regained 70% of the weight they lost, and they were burning on average 500 fewer calories a day than their peers of the same weight. In other words, they had to eat less than other people to maintain their weight. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It just doesn't seem fair, does it? But as my guest will explain, scientists are discovering that body weight depends on more than just calories eaten over calories burned, and evolution has wired our brains and bodies to want to stay at a weight we might not like. Neuroscientist Sandra Amott is the former editor of the brain research journal Nature Neuroscience. Her new book is called Why Diets Make Us Fat: The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. Sandra, welcome to Think.
Great to be here.
You note in your introduction, if diets worked, we would all be thin by now. What evidence shows that diets don't work?
There's never been a long-term study that's shown that the majority of people could lose 10% of their body weight and keep it off for more than a couple of years.
Wow.
It's very consistent in the literature.
And so what we do is we look at those failures and we ascribe them to the individuals who have tried to lose weight.
Exactly. We say, well, you lost weight, and the fact that you couldn't keep that weight off, that's not my fault, that's your fault. I helped you lose weight.
So why do some people get fat when others don't?
So I think it's pretty straightforward why people get fat. I mean, we're living in an environment that just begs us to get fat. And there's food available all the time. It's high in calories. It's easy to get. It tastes good. And no humans in history have lived like that until just the past few decades. But the reason that particular people tend to gain weight more easily than others is largely due to their genetics, that some people are more responsive to that kind of a food environment than others of us.
What is the evolutionary purpose for that set point our bodies have for weight?
So weight is really highly regulated, and if you think about it, it should be, not only in humans but in other animals as well, because you have to put, in a wild condition, you have to put a lot of energy into finding out, defining food and eating it, and you don't want to be doing less of that than you need, and you don't want to be doing more of it than you need because you might then use that energy for other things. And the reason that the brain is so particularly unhappy about weight loss is because historically that's been the main threat, right? The odds of eating way too much have not historically been a big problem for people. The odds of starving to death, on the other hand, have been noticeable.
So what happens when, by dieting or something else, we stray above or below that set point that we have?
So in either direction, actually, the brain reacts to that and tries to push us back to what it considers normal. Now, what your brain considers normal and what your doctor considers normal may not be the same, but people who eat enough to gain weight above their normal range typically get an increase in their metabolism. They burn more calories. They get less hungry. And people who go below their set point range do the opposite. They burn fewer calories, and they particularly burn fewer calories during exercise. And they're hungrier, and food is more rewarding to them. And you know, every unconscious dirty trick your brain could use to try to make you gain that weight back, it's going to use.
And if our brains could defend themselves, they would say, they're not dirty tricks. I'm trying to keep you alive in the famine.
Exactly. All I'm trying to do is keep you from starving.
It turns out we can edge that set point up by gaining weight and keeping it on over time, but we cannot dial it down by dieting. Is that right?
All the evidence suggests that all the things that I just mentioned that the brain does to keep people from gaining weight last for at least 6 years after a weight loss, and as far as anybody's been able to show, they probably last forever. The things that the brain does to keep you from gaining weight, on the other hand, don't continue for a long time. If you keep that weight on, the brain will basically say, okay, fine, I give up. Go ahead, keep that weight on. See if I care.
All right, what can we tell? Everybody loves a twin study. What can we tell about the genetics of weight set points by looking at identical or fraternal twins?
Probably my single favorite study was done on identical twins. It was an inpatient study, okay, so the researchers had complete control of their eating and exercise. And they had them do 1,000 calories a day of extra exercise for 90 days. So that's 90,000 calories extra that they burned. And in every case, the two identical twins lost the same amount of weight. But between pairs, the weight loss varied from 19 pounds at the high end to 2 pounds at the low end. So those twins had to cut 45,000 calories out of their diet to lose a pound.
Wow, that's enough to make you throw your hands up, isn't it?
It does make you think that maybe weight loss is not the correct prescription for everybody.
Sandra, are some people naturally more or less hungry than others?
Certainly, people have different natural weights. And, you know, all of us are motivated to maintain our natural weight, whatever that is. Or however we have manipulated it over the course of our lives, right? Because it doesn't necessarily stay the same forever. As you mentioned, it can go up for various reasons.
So this study in the journal Obesity found that Biggest Loser contestants, as I mentioned in the introduction, gained back a lot of the weight they lost in the years following the broadcast they were featured in. We might just assume they slipped back into their old habits, but even if they didn't, it turns out they couldn't eat as much as before. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. So that's been known actually for a while from studies of more traditional dieters, but this is the best measurement we've ever gotten on it because the researchers knew that these people were going to lose a lot of weight and try really hard to keep it off. So they were able to study them before the show began, right after it ended, and now 6 years later. And there were several interesting things. First of all, that when you lose a whole lot of weight, these metabolic effects are big. I mean, there was one person who was burning 800 fewer calories than would be expected for someone who looked like that. And that was the one person who had actually maintained the weight loss. One of the people who had gained all of the weight back still had a suppressed metabolism. That's been very controversial in the literature, and it probably doesn't happen to most people. But it looks like it can happen, at least in some cases. And for the rest of the people, their metabolism was presumably suppressed because they were still below their weight set point. Even though they had gained back 70% of the weight, that still left them 30 or 40 or 50 pounds below normal.
When you adapted this book for the New York Times, I looked at some of the comments and there were people who said, well, that whole thing was all because people on that show lose weight so quickly. Is there an effect? Does it matter how quickly or how slowly one loses weight?
There have been several studies looking at whether losing weight quickly versus slowly matters to these metabolic effects, whether it matters to weight gain. they have all uniformly found no difference. And yet that remains one of our most persistent weight loss myths.
Right. You hear people say, do it right, lose it slowly, and then you'll keep it off. But there's no evidence that that is true.
I mean, I agree that losing it slowly probably makes it easier to maintain the habits that allowed you to lose the weight. But it's not going to do anything at all, as far as we can tell, about this brain response.
Sandra, what's the relationship between weight anxiety and eating behaviors?
So people who feel bad about their bodies are more likely in long-term studies to gain weight than people who start out at an identical weight but are happy with it. And that is true across a variety of weights, including in people who start out in the normal weight range, including in people who start out underweight, actually. People who start out underweight and want to lose weight also tend to gain. And the reason for that most likely is because it feels really miserable to hate your body. And people who feel like that are very prone to comfort eating and they're very prone to not exercising. I mean, why would you want to dress your body in spandex and take it outside if even thinking about what you look like makes you sick?
How do cues in the environment play into, like, binge eating behaviors?
So binge eaters have triggers, usually. So there's some food or some situation that makes them prone to binge. But what actually seems to lead to binge eating, in a lot of cases, is repeated calorie restriction. So when scientists want to study binge eating in rodents, the way that they induce it is to alternate calorie restriction and tasty food. Now, what do most of us do when we're dieting? We alternate calorie restriction with tasty food, right? And that repeated dieting is a predictor of the development of binge eating later in life.
So you can turn a rat into a habitual binge eater with these restrictions.
Yep.
Wow.
Give it some Oreos, make it lose 20% of its weight, let it gain the weight back, give it some Oreos, do that a few times, and you've got a rat that'll binge eat.
How can moderate dieting trigger eating disorders?
Extreme dieting triggers more eating disorders than moderate dieting, but the difference isn't as big as we would like to think. It seems to be that the weight loss itself may be what indicates to your brain, oh, I better stock up. That food might disappear any minute.
So it would seem that dieting, then it triggers an eating disorder where you're gaining too much weight rather than triggering something like anorexia.
Both, actually. There's a surprisingly large relationship between different eating disorders. It's relatively common, more common than not, for people who have an eating disorder at some point in their life to have a different one later on.
We're speaking go ahead.
No, go ahead.
We're speaking this hour with neuroscientist Sandra Ammett, former editor of the brain research journal Nature and Neuroscience. Her new book is called Why Diets Make Us Fat: The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
So basically, everybody thinks that the show gave wonderful tools, and they did not. They were advising you.
Diet and exercise.
They were advising you. Bob Harper would tell me, eat 800 calories. Suzanne, if you eat that many calories, we'll win a weigh-in because you're eating less. I would train every single day and vomit on the set. And they said, great, you'll even lose more weight. Again, we'll win another weigh-in.
They were happy to see you throw up.
They did not address contestants throwing up on a daily basis. They created eating disorders. They did not try to provide any assistance or help to any of these people because you would not advocate for an 800-calorie diet in 8 hours
so
a day training.
They were encouraging you to starve.
Yes.
Which is not good for you.
No, absolutely not. And that's why you have majority of these contestants heavy again.
That was former Biggest Loser contestant Suzanne Mendoca on Fox News talking with Steve Doocy about her experience on the show. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Sandra Ammett, former editor of the brain research journal Nature Neuroscience. She has a new book out called Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can find us on Twitter at KERA. Think. Sandra, some of the information that you've given us so far might give people who have struggled with their weight some comfort, some sense that they are vindicated, that it's not necessarily some moral failure, that they have failed to maintain the weight that is considered normal or appropriate. On the other hand, you know, there's still concerns about health. A lot of discrimination against fat people is couched in terms of concern for their health. It turns out, as you discover, that the effect of weight on health is complicated. There is a relationship, but it's not as straightforward as people might believe.
Right. It's not necessarily a causal relationship. A lot of what we mistake for effects of obesity on health are probably better explained by being effects of lack of exercise, low fitness. So just to give you a headline example, low fitness, high blood pressure, poverty, and loneliness all predict your risk of death better than your weight. You imagine a national war on loneliness?
It might not be a bad idea, but
might not be a bad idea. It would actually save more lives than a war on obesity. And there's basically, you'd have better luck, probably.
We know for a fact that an overweight person has a higher risk of developing, say, type 2 diabetes than someone who has always been thin, which is not to say that's necessarily a causal relationship. But is there evidence that a body dieted down from being obese to being in the normal range is equivalent in terms of health to one that has never been overweight?
No. People have looked at that and those studies have been disappointing. So the most successful behavioral diet intervention study that's ever been done is called the Look-Ahead Study. And they managed to get 27% of their group to lose at least 10% of their weight and keep it off for 8 years, which is an amazing result. Nobody had ever done anywhere near that well. That required 300 contacts with dietitians, psychologists, exercise specialists, and in the same study, 26.4% of people ended up gaining weight over the 8 years. So the very best is not so great. But the purpose of that study was actually to look at whether people who were diabetic when the study began, who are at highly elevated risk of heart problems later on, would experience less heart disease and less mortality if they were put on this unusually successful diet. And that study was terminated just before its 10th anniversary because statistical analysis, the charmingly named futility analysis, indicated that it wasn't going to work, that they were not saving any lives by this diet.
So there is a message to folks that moving, getting exercise is important. Lots of people believe that that will automatically lead to weight loss. Why, if we're burning, say, 200 calories a day, jogging or walking or rowing, don't we lose weight over the course of time?
Probably because we're eating more.
Mm-hmm.
So exercise makes you healthy. It also makes you hungry. Because the whole point of this brain system is to regulate your weight and keep it stable. So if you eat all the right things, you eat your vegetables, you don't eat too much sugar, you don't eat too much processed foods, you get enough fiber, you exercise a lot, you're probably going to be at the low end of that 10 or 15 pound weight range instead of the high end. But those kinds of lifestyle changes don't move people out of their defended weight range.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Donna on the line in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi, excuse me. Hi, Chris and Dr. Amit. A very interesting show, and I have been up and down and up and down and up. Right now I'm up again. In the last 3 years, I was a professional ballerina, and most of my life I was a size 4, at most a size 6. I am now a size 10. I'm very discouraged, and I'd like the doctor's advice for what should I do. I don't have to be dancer weight anymore because I'm 60 years old, but I would like to be a size 6 again.
Any thoughts, Sandra?
So it's pretty common for people to slowly gain weight as they get older, typically somewhere in the range of half a pound or a pound a year. And I'll tell you one thing that may be reassuring, which is that once you're in your 60s, it's actually healthier to be heavier than it is when you're younger. There's no relationship between weight gain and health once people are over 65. But in terms of what you can do to try to get back into your favorite pants, the best thing I can tell you is to adjust your lifestyle in the healthiest way you can think of and then let it do what it wants to do, because the alternative is that you continue to struggle like this and you're not at a weight that is any kind of a health risk.
You did a little experiment with your New Year's resolution a few years ago and made the kind of New Year's resolution that very few people make. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so in 2010, for New Year's, I decided that I was going to stop dieting, and I had been a dedicated dieter for more than 3 decades. I had lost the same 10 or 15 pounds, probably 20 or 30 times, and that I was not going to weigh myself. I was going to stop caring about what I weighed, and that I was going to exercise every single day. I kept all three of those resolutions for the entire year and for all of the 5 years since. I still do all those things.
And how's your body? Are you happy with it?
I am. I'm not as thin as I was when I was at the bottom of my dieting cycle. I'm right about in the middle, actually, of between the lowest weight that I reached when I was dieting and the highest weight that I reached when I was dieting. And I don't have to buy new pants twice a year.
So you're at your set point.
Everything fits.
Yeah.
I'm at my set point. I stay there. I don't worry about it. I don't stress about eating. I enjoy my food. There's just this huge amount of energy that I used to spend running and gaining nothing that I now have available to do things that really do improve my health.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Matthew on the line in Lake Highlands. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. My wife and I just celebrated the birth of our third child, and we've been kind of looking back over pictures of our daughters over time and as they've aged and how we have aged. I was wondering if pregnancy had any influence on how our brain deals with weight or influences our set point over time.
Thanks for your call.
Pregnancy can increase the set point. It doesn't always, but it seems to in some women. That may just be a special case of the idea that once you gain weight, it's hard to lose. Nobody really understands entirely biologically why it is that set points go up, but it is a pretty common observation that people find that their set point has gone up after a pregnancy.
All right, back to the phones now. We have Bill on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, Sandra mentioned the metabolism rate a couple of times, and I'm wondering what causes fluctuations in metabolism rates and whether they can be manipulated.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, actually. So the reason that people's bodies burn less energy when they're below their set point range is because their muscles actually use less ATP, less chemical energy, to do the same work. They're more efficient. You've basically gone from being an SUV to being a Prius. You can get more done with the same amount of energy. And if you think about that in evolutionary terms, it makes an enormous amount of sense, right? What does a person who's a hunter-gatherer who's starving need more than anything else? They need to be able to walk farther looking for food, which obviously is not available where they are, and they need to not starve to death while they're doing it. So for them, this is a great adaptation. On the other hand, if you're somebody who's dieting and spending your time out walking to try to lose weight, the more weight you lose, the more walking you actually have to do to burn the same number of calories. It's not such good news.
It's been interesting to see over the past few years. I think a lot of people still assume that obesity rates continue to, you know, we use all these hyperbolic words, skyrocket. But in fact, they've leveled off, right? The rates of people who are overweight in this country. Is that probably because only a certain percentage of the population is susceptible to being overweight?
It probably means that everybody who is responsive to our current food environment has already reacted to it. I'm sure that if we found some way to line the sidewalks with chocolate, or I'm trying to think how we could make it worse, right? But if you did figure out how to make it even easier to overeat, probably more of us would do it. But it's not just like everybody is, you know, we're going to continue to have this increase in obesity until everybody is obese, because there are people who respond differently to these kinds of temptations.
If it appears we might be better off and have an easier time maintaining what's considered a normal body mass index if we never get overweight in the first place, it would seem that healthy weight management in childhood is important. But there are some caveats in terms of the messages we want to give children about weight. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So interventions that teach kids about the importance of exercise and healthy eating have had long-term effects. I mean, long-term meaning a couple of years, on preventing weight gain. But the catch is that obsessing about your child's weight is more likely to do harm than good. If you say to a child, okay, your job is to keep your weight low, then what happens is the same thing that happens in adults, only more so. They become more likely to binge eat, they hate their bodies, they end up gaining weight in the long term, either because of the increased eating and decreased exercise that we know happens to people when they hate their bodies, or because of the stress that's caused by having your parents picking on you about your weight. On the other hand, if you don't talk about your kid's body, you don't talk about your body, you don't make fun of the bodies of the people you see on the street or on television, you serve healthy food, regular home-cooked meals that you guys eat together, you go out and ride bicycles or run around the backyard as a family, all those things have been shown to help to keep kids from gaining weight as they get older.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Syed on the line in Frisco. Hi, Syed.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is about this month, especially because this is Ramadan. And is there any relation between losing weight and fasting? And also, how is your brain telling you not to eat as you fast or isn't your brain overcoming the desire to eat when you're fasting? So,
interesting questions. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a new one. So fasting requires willpower, and we can suppress eating with willpower. The problem is that we can't do that for years on end. So for a few weeks, maybe a month, willpower works okay to keep control of eating. But eventually it wears out. People who have used too much willpower run out of it, and then they end up slipping and in some cases binging. So if you needed, you know, if Ramadan lasted all year, I think you would start to see that people couldn't stick with it.
Let's go to the phones now and speak with Candace in Dallas. Hi, Candace.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I am, I had a gastric bypass 7 years ago, and I lost roughly 185 pounds. I think at my heaviest I was 350, and now I float at like 130 and have stayed there. I'm also very aware that I'm a weight loss surgery unicorn and that people like me, you know, all the people I know from support groups who got surgery around the same time I did, have not only regained the weight that they lost post-surgery, but then the added 20, 30, 40 pounds. Are there any studies that you know of that have kind of followed this trend?
Yeah, so bariatric surgery is a really interesting example because it appears to work not the way that most people think by just making it hard to eat, but instead by actually changing the set point.
Let me jump in here because we're going to take a quick break and I want you to have time to explain this. We're speaking this hour with neuroscientist Sandra Amett, former editor of Nature Neuroscience and author of the new book, Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for fall. Deadline is July 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with neuroscientist Sandra Amett, author of Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. Before the break, we heard from Candace, who said she had successful weight loss surgery a number of years ago, has managed to keep her weight down. And you were telling us, Sandra, that it may be that the surgery changed her weight set point.
That's right. I should point out that weight loss surgery has some very serious side effects and is by no means a solution for everybody. As Candace points out, she had an unusually good response to it. A more typical response would be that somebody loses about 20 or 30% of their original weight. And there's a lot of variability. Some people lose a whole lot. Some people, as she said, gain it all back, and then some. When I say that it can change the set point, don't say, oh, wow, I definitely have to do that, because it's a very serious decision. But animal experiments indicate that rats who have bariatric surgery voluntarily reduce their weight, even though they are capable of eating enough to gain weight. They just choose not to. And that's the basis for the statement that it seems to actually change the set point.
An email from Chaz asks, is a set point disruption drug in trials that you know of?
There are only a handful of weight loss drugs, and so there is one possibility that I know of that looks like a drug that might actually change the set point. And it's only in rodents right now, so it's a long, long way from being used in people. But what it does in rodents is that it changes the gut bacteria in a way that increases metabolism and keeps the animals from gaining weight on a high-fat diet and makes it much, much easier for them to lose weight. It seems like it might have some of the same effects of weight loss surgery, but in a pill. And that would be a game changer. The drugs we have right now are worth 5 or 10 pounds, and only if you are actually on a diet and only if you keep taking the drugs. So they're not really very helpful at this stage.
Are weight loss drugs meant to be taken indefinitely, or are they meant to be taken for a short amount of time?
It depends on the drug, what the official prescription recommendation is. But it's systematically true that when you stop taking the drug, you will probably gain back the extra weight that the drug helped you lose.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Chad on the line in Dallas. Hi, Chad.
Howdy. I actually have a friend who's a former ballet dancer also. She was standard weight for ballet dancers. Her set point, however, is probably around 300, 350, which she is at now. When she was much thinner, she was quite ill, didn't feel good. When she is at her set weight, her set point, she actually feels good. She is actually more healthy. Her blood pressure, all the other marker levels that doctors use, are much more normal, and she's much happier. And I would be interested to hear your guest comment on that.
Yeah, so that is possible. There are a number of people who are both obese and healthy. Most of them exercise quite a bit. That if you're looking to make yourself healthier, even though you can't or aren't trying to lose weight, then regular exercise is my number one recommendation. And about 16% of people who are in the obese range have no health problems whatsoever, as far as anybody can tell. And your friend is one of those.
We have an email here from David who says, I think this discussion is missing the point. If you want to get the right answer, you need to ask the right question. Weight is not a problem. Fat is a problem. What do you say to that, Sandra?
I would go him one better and say that abdominal fat is mostly the problem in terms of health. But nobody is thinking that the problem is NFL players, many of whom have so much muscle that they technically qualify for the obese category. What I'm saying is that somebody can actually carry a considerable amount of fat and still be healthy as long as that fat is distributed in the right way. And people can be very thin and unhealthy if they carry a lot of fat inside their abdomen. This is one of the reasons that exercise is such a good idea, because exercise preferentially burns the fat that's inside your belly, and that is by far the worst kind of fat for health.
That's another thing that people don't have any control over. Some people, you know, gain weight in their bellies. Some people gain weight sort of in the lower halves of their body, and there's no way to change that as far as we know, is there?
No, the distribution of body fat is also highly genetic.
All right, let's
go. You got it from your parents, and you're stuck with it for the most part.
For better or for worse. All right, let's go to Derek in the colony. Hi, Derek.
Hi. That's what I was literally just begging you guys to let me talk. I'm actually really on point with what you guys are saying right now. I study biochemistry, and I've experimented with supplements for a long time, and one of the particularly interesting ones are supplements that increase what they like to call thermogenesis. It's the buzzword that they use. But the basic idea is that they actually change the way your fat behaves so that it behaves more like
brown instead of white adipose tissue, which, as I understand, white adipose tissue, it doesn't get burned nearly as easily and can't be used as well for, like, warming your body or producing energy.
What do you know about that, Sandra?
I am generally not inclined to recommend supplements because they're not regulated and it's very hard to know what's actually in them. In some cases, they can be quite dangerous. But people have been trying for a long, long time to find some magic pill that's going to manipulate their metabolism and, you know, burn fat while you sleep, as the old TV ads used to say. And I'm pretty sure when somebody comes up with something like that, it will not remain a secret for long. As far as I know, we don't have anything like that now.
All right, let's talk now to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, I've had a private practice in clinical nutrition for 25 years, and when we see clients that are seeking weight loss, we study their nutrient density to find out where that is along with their set point. And what we know is that today in our food source is that 60 to 70% is less nutrient dense than it was 50, 60 years ago. And those vital enzymes and the letter vitamins, specifically B vitamins that run our mitochondrial cells to produce ATP, are just not there in abundance like they were when we were kids. And we find that as we adjust those, that that the set point is reached at a quicker rate. And I use myself as an example. I'm 60, and at 25, I was 162, and at 60, I'm 164. And so there are ways to maintain that without having to dedicate your life to exercise and dieting for your life. And I just wanted to make that point.
Thanks for your call.
So I completely agree that eating nutritious food from the beginning is one of the best ways to keep your weight from going up over time. And I would not be at all surprised if it turns out that the idea, which I've heard a number of times, that a decrease in the nutrient density of our food supply is part of the reason that people are getting motivated to eat more, that could easily be true. That doesn't necessarily imply that people who reverse those decisions after they've gained weight will then lose weight. That's the tricky part.
So when you say, you know, the nutrient density is lower today, basically what you're saying is we're eating more calories of junk food, maybe not taking in the nourishment that our body is actually seeking.
Right. We're eating more processed food and fewer whole foods, and the processing that occurs to make processed food basically involves removing fiber and nutrients and then adding some of them back, but right. probably not all of them, and probably not all the important ones.
And a vitamin supplement doesn't necessarily have the same effect on your body as that vitamin occurring in a whole natural food.
Right. You end up with weird proportions of vitamins. You end up with too much of some and not enough of others. It's a lot more effective to get your vitamins from actual food than it is to get them from pills.
All right, let's speak with Jim in Irving. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I was wondering, with low-calorie or low-carb carbohydrate diets, you know, if you go on one of those for 72 hours, if you haven't had any carbohydrates, your body switches over and just starts burning fat. And it's really effective, although it doesn't last long, obviously, until you start eating carbohydrates. And I'm wondering, what is that process? Why can't we synthetically emulate that with a pill or something that we could take and tell the body to burn fat if we know what it is? That would be my first question. Then second, what
We just have time for one, so thank you so much for that question, Jim.
Yeah, I think the low-carb diets have the same regain rate in the long term as any of the other diets that have been studied. Some people find them easier to stay on, and that's fine, but the long-term effects don't seem to be any different.
Are you hearing?
And yes, everyone wants the fat burning pill. That's what we've learned here today.
Are you hearing, Sandra, from people who picked up this book assuming it was another diet book and that you would have a list of tips for, you know, effective weight loss?
I actually have not heard that so far. We went to a lot of trouble to design the cover and the title to try to get across to people that this isn't a diet book. But there are so many diet books out there that it turns out to, if you have the word diet on your cover, it turns out to be actually really hard to convince people that you're not going to help them lose weight.
Is there a way that you can convince people that exercise, and the other thing that you note in the book multiple times is that not smoking is really important for long-term health. Like if you happen to be overweight and you also smoke, you really magnify the bad effects of both of those things.
Yeah, smoking is one of the things that predicts your risk of early death better than obesity. And a lot of people used to smoke because it kept their weight down. As much as a third of the increase in population weight gain among women in the last few decades can be explained by the number of people who've quit smoking. And we are way healthier because of that.
What kind of exercise does everybody need?
So you can get most of the benefits of exercise with about half an hour a day of something moderate. You can get the same benefit with maybe 10 minutes of really intense exercise or a larger amount of lower intensity exercise. Every bit counts. Any exercise is better than none. A reasonable amount is better. Once you get to about an hour a day, you've probably maxed out your benefits. You probably don't need any more than that.
So you might be training for an event or something and you want to keep exercising, but in terms of the health benefits, an hour a day is the maximum we can benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. And you get about 3/4 of the benefits from a half hour a day.
Just curious before we finish, when you thought about your audience for this book, did you have in mind people who want to change their weight but have struggled to do so, or people who believe that body weight is a matter of choice and that people who've struggled with their weight should be ashamed?
So I'm looking for two different groups of people here. I'm looking for readers who have tried over and over again to lose weight and are blaming themselves and feeling bad about it and looking for some more effective way forward. And I'm also, and the parents of young people like that, very much so. I would love to change the conversation between parents and children around weight. And I would also just like to have the national conversation around weight include a few more facts.
Journalist Sandra Ammett is former editor of, neuroscientist Sandra Ammett is former editor of the brain research journal Nature Neuroscience, and she's author of the new book, Why Diets Make Us Fat, The Unintended Consequences of Our Obsession with Weight Loss. Sandra, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's been fascinating for me, too.
I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.